callherganda.com. You can connect with Naomi Fontanos and Gender and Development Advocates Filipinas on Facebook at Ganda Filipinas. Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Melanie Keller and Michael Taylor Gray, produced by Brian DeShazer, and by Lucia Chappell, with a big thank you to Christopher Gall. Stevie Wonder and Jason Mraz performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks to kicking assets from the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, and donors Judd Proctor and Brian Burns, and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on CKUW Winnipeg, Manitoba, KGNU Denver, Boulder, Ward, and Fort Collins, Colorado, WERU Bangor, Maine, and a wide array of community, terrestrial, and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy and stay tuned.
Listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
From the studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. In today's news headlines, massive trove of documents turned over to BuzzFeed News and analyzed by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists has exposed how trillions of dollars of dirty money is passing through some of the world's largest banks. The documents were essentially suspicious activities reports filed with the U.S. federal government's Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. The FinCEN documents, as they're called, reveal, according to ICIJ, that, quote, J.P. Morgan Chase, HSBC, and other big banks have defied money laundering crackdowns by moving staggering sums of illicit cash for shadowy characters and criminal networks that have spread chaos and undermined democracy all around the world. Additionally, quote, in some cases, the banks kept moving illicit funds even after U.S. officials warned them they'd face criminal prosecutions if they didn't stop doing business with mobsters, fraudsters, or corrupt regimes, end of quote. Among the figures implicated in the documents is Trump's former campaign chief, Paul Manafort. We'll bring you more on this story later on. In news from the coronavirus, nearly 200,000 people have died in the U.S. from the disease, by far the worst virus-related death toll of any nation in the world. The state of Texas leads in the nation in the number of new cases of infection being documented. The Lone Star State has the third highest overall death toll after New York and New Jersey, respectively. Following Texas is California in the number of COVID-19 deaths. As the nation reaches the grim milestone, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on Friday revised its guidance on the disease, confirming what most scientists the world over were saying, that the airborne transmission is, quote, thought to be the main way the virus spreads. But then on Monday, the CDC extraordinarily removed that new guidance, saying it had been posted in error, once more undermining the reputation of the once respected government agency. A new ABC News Ipsos poll found that a majority of Americans do not trust Trump to confirm the safety or effectiveness of any new COVID-19 vaccine. A white bar owner from Nebraska has killed himself hours before he was set to turn himself in for the murder of a Black Lives Matter protester. Jake Gardner was charged with fatally shooting a 22-year-old black man named James Scurlock on May 30th during protests over George Floyd's police killing. And New York's Attorney General Letitia James has announced that her office will now decide whether or not to release body camera footage in cases of officer-involved killings. The decision came after footage of Daniel Prude's death by asphyxiation in Rochester was withheld for months. Meanwhile, the Justice Department has formally recommended that the federal government withhold funds from the cities of New York, Portland, and Seattle, all Democratic-run cities. Attorney General William Barr, who's been accused of politicizing his department to favor Trump, made the recommendations based on what he says has been mismanagement of anti-police brutality protests. Trump does not have the legal authority to withhold funds from certain cities, although he's often threatened to do so. Fires continue to burn in California, Washington, and Oregon, but some parts of the Northwest saw an easing off from cooler, more damp weather. In Southern California, the Bobcat Fire exploded in size over the weekend to become one of the largest in the history of Los Angeles County and prompted evacuations in the Antelope Valley. On the other side of the nation, Tropical Storm Beta is expected to batter the already hurricane-worn states of Louisiana and Texas with large amounts of rain on Monday. And that does it for our news headlines. We'll be back with the rest of the show after this break. KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The second woman to ever serve on the United States Supreme Court, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, has died, shocking the nation. After a lengthy battle with metastatic pancreatic cancer, the feminist icon and trailblazing jurist passed away on Friday at 87, leaving behind one dying wish that her replacement would be chosen until after a new president was elected. But within hours of her death, Republican senators began expressing glee and planning a replacement to be voted on in lightning speed. Typically, it takes several months for a president to pick a nominee and for the Senate to hold hearings and a vote. The election is less than 50 days away. Joining me to discuss her legacy and the political battle brewing to fill RGB's seat is Corey Brettschneider, professor of political science at Brown University. He's the author of When the State Speaks, What Should It Say? How Democracies Can Protect Expression and Promote Equality, as well as The Oath in the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. His latest book, published September 8th, is Decisions and Dissents of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, A Selection. Welcome, Corey.
Thank you, Sonali. It's a sad occasion, but I'm happy to talk about the importance of Justice Ginsburg's legacy for all of us. And it's a time of mourning, but it's also a time of celebration of this amazing life.
So there were vigils all around the country at courthouses. Certainly the political battle about who is to replace her looms large, and she too understood it, given what she said to her granddaughter just days before she passed away. But let's focus on her legacy and what she achieved. What are the decisions? And she was known for her scathing and eloquent dissents, but what are the decisions that you can really attribute to her?
I think the true victory, the reason why she is often and rightly compared to Thurgood Marshall as one of the most important litigators and justices of our country's history, is her decision in the women's rights case about the Virginia Military Institute. That is really a culmination of her entire life's work. She began as a litigator with a simple idea, which was that the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, although it was passed after the Civil War and was focused and intended to rectify inequality based on race, the same principle applied to inequality based on gender, or what she often called sex. The principle, she said, was that you can't allow arbitrary discrimination against people for attributes that don't limit their ability. And what better example of that than the right of women to attend a military academy? There were women, she argued, who were more than able, certainly intellectually capable and physically able, to attend that academy, and it was discrimination and a violation of our Constitution that public institution didn't allow it. She went from litigating cases about that topic to deciding one that really solidified her rightful view that under our Constitution, women cannot be denied equal protection of the laws.
So she was someone whose presence on the court was also seen as a bulwark against attacks on the Roe versus Wade decision to ensure that abortion remains a constitutional right. Is there a body of work or dissenting opinions that you can look back on to capture her position on reproductive rights for women?
There was a case that she litigated, actually, when she was at, I believe, the ACLU, called Strzok, that was about a woman in the military was basically denied the right to have an abortion absent penalties from that institution. And she argued vigorously in court, lower courts, that this was a denial also of the equal protection of laws. And that opened up her approach, the way that she really saw this issue, until the day she died, which was that the way to really conceive of abortion was as an equality issue, that denying women, it's only women who get pregnant, and so denying them this procedure is a discrimination based on sex and gender, and it shouldn't be allowed. Now, the court didn't go in that direction. They relied on a more general right of privacy, individual liberty right. And even though she disagreed with it, she thought the right was so essential that she didn't let her kind of squabble with the reasoning get in the way of being a vigorous defender of Roe as a member of the court. And that meant that in Casey, when the court upheld things like a 24-hour waiting period, and in other cases where the court tried to limit abortion rights, she was vigorously dissenting from
Now, Justice Ginsburg was the second woman to be on the court after Sandra Day O'Connor. After her, of course, came Elena Kagan and Sonia Sotomayor. There have been only four women on the court. She was also Jewish. She died on Rosh Hashanah. How significant was that?
I think that when she talked about that, it was another perspective. Our Constitution, at its best, is about the protection of minority rights. And the idea that what a democracy is not just the ability of a majority to impose its will on a minority. Certainly what it's not is handing over all power to a president who's then all powerful. And that sort of empathy, that thought about minority rights was partly, I think, captured by her experiences as a woman. She talked often about experiences that she had as a student and certainly as a young lawyer trying to get hired, facing discrimination. And so she knew, not just at an abstract and intellectual level, what equal protection of the law meant for women, but as a personal experience. And I think that Judaism probably informed that as well, that experiencing America and the Ivy League as a Jewish woman probably carried with it a sense of being different and a sense of the importance of religious minorities. But what was great about her was that, of course, like all great civil rights heroes, she took those individual experiences based on religion, based on discrimination, based on gender, and extended it to issues where she was not facing discrimination. And she was a terrific defender of African-American civil rights, in particular the right to vote. So her dissent in the Shelby County decision, which really rightly and vigorously goes after the majority for stripping the 1965 Civil Rights Act of its power, the coverage formula that said if you're going to change voting rules and you have a history of discrimination in areas specifically like adding requirements of ID, even though there's no evidence that people are cheating, suppressing the vote, the court struck down the part of that act that required oversight from the Department of Justice, and she really came at it with as much vigor as she did in these other areas, and said, you know, she wasn't a black woman, but she said, you know, this is pure discrimination, pure denial of the idea of equal rights, and you know, a civil rights hero doesn't just defend the minorities of which he or she is a part, but of all.
And she did come under some criticism for an opinion that she shared a few years ago about Colin Kaepernick and his kneeling protest during the national anthem. She called it dumb and disrespectful. A lot of people said that was one of the few places where she sort of countered her, undermined her own liberal legacy. And there were some other issues on Palestinian rights as well. Certainly she was not perfect. A few people are. One of the points of criticism that really becomes relevant today is that people have looked back on the time when she could have been replaced very easily by a Democratic president had she chosen to retire when both President Obama was in the White House and the Senate was controlled by Democrats, and she chose to power through. What do you make of that criticism?
I think, you know, you're right. She wasn't perfect. I think the legacy that I'm talking about in the book, and that's why I really focus on the decisions and dissents of the Supreme Court that she wrote, her work as a litigator, those were her finest hours. Now, when you're in the public eye, as long as she has, you say things that are wrong. And certainly I do not agree with what she said about the protests, which were essential to generating the most important social movement of our time, Black Lives Matter. But you know, I do think that those are remarks that she was making, and it's different than the right. considered decision of a
that
judge.
That wasn't part of her a dissent she wrote, or an opinion she wrote
exactly.
for the court.
Yeah, I think I would. You know, Justice Kennedy, who has a true mixed legacy in that he was the pioneer of the gay rights jurisprudence, and at the same time, in the travel ban case, really abandoned the idea of minority rights, and probably the most important moment in his. In his career, when we were faced with a despotic president, I have no problem with saying that he really tarred his legacy and undermined it. Whereas I would say these remarks are wrong and, you know, should be criticized and condemned. But thankfully, they were not things that she did as a justice. And I do think that's a distinction.
Right. What about the decision to remain on the court and risk exactly the moment we find ourselves in today, which is where not just a Republican president, but a Republican president like Trump is going to try all he can to replace her with as right-wing and as young a judge as possible. She did have the chance to retire and have her replacement be picked by a Democrat, but she chose to not do so.
I agree with you. I think that was a terrible error of judgment. I would not call it a moral failing as much as a failure of knowledge, which many of us had. I think that there was a confidence in that last election that this real joke of the candidate, and he was a joke of a candidate in the sense that he was not to be taken as a morally serious person, couldn't win. And we were naive, many of us. I mean, I didn't believe Trump was going to win. And I think that's just what she thought, that she could keep going on and fighting that fight. And, you know, she didn't know who she was going to be replaced with. I think she wanted somebody on the court that was going to continue the fight, especially for women's rights, which, you know, the ERA still hasn't been passed. And the gains that we've had are largely due to her. And I think that's what she imagined. Now, she was just wrong, as many of us were. She should have stepped down. Absolutely.
So Hypocrite Mitch is a hashtag that's trending. And of course, that refers to what happened in the last year of Obama's office. It was the summer, I believe, of 2016 when Justice Antonin Scalia, right-wing justice, unexpectedly died. And Obama put forward Merrick Garland to replace him. And Republicans who controlled the Senate, led, of course, by Mitch McConnell, fought tooth and nail pulled out all the stops, rolled out every argument possible to insist that Obama had no right to replace a justice on the court, even though he did. And, you know, Mitch McConnell, of course, doesn't care. But Lindsey Graham actually said, you can use my words against me. And he laid out a scenario that is eerily exactly what we have today. And I want to actually play for you and our audience Lindsey Graham's words in 2016 before we come back to you, Corey, with a sense of where the Republicans are today. This is Lindsey Graham talking about why Merrick Garland should not be nominated by or confirmed to the Supreme Court in 2016.
This is the last year of a lame duck president. And if Ted Cruz or Donald Trump get to be president, they've all asked us not to confirm or take up a selection by President Obama. So if a vacancy occurs in their last year of their first term, guess what? You will use their words against them. I want you to use my words against me. If there's a Republican president in 2016 and a vacancy occurs in the last year of the first term, you can say, Lindsey Graham said, let's let the next president, whoever it might be, make that nomination. And you could use my words against me and you'd be absolutely right.
That is Senator Lindsey Graham saying that you can use my words against me and you'd be absolutely right. Corey Bridgeschneider, the hypocrisy is quite stunning, isn't it?
Oh, it's outrageous. I mean, you know, and it has a gaslighting quality to it where they said you can't hold these hearings in for a nominee of the Supreme Court in a presidential election year. It's a presidential election year. And now they're going back and saying, well, throughout history, we've had these hearings. And it's beyond hypocrisy. It's a kind of gross lying to the American people. And it's about pure power, the idea that they'll even couch it in principle is an insult, and it really is a insult to the intelligence of the American people. You know, that is a stolen seat. That's the way to refer to what happened to Garland, and Democrats have to do absolutely everything they can to stop this appointment from happening before the election. If we fail to do so, rightfully we'll engage in a discussion about whether we need to add a 10th justice to reclaim that stolen seat.
Let's talk about that. That's a really critical part that I think is not as well known. The fact that there is no specification in the Constitution that there be only 9 seats on the Supreme Court. And I understand there's also no aspect of the Constitution that suggests that justices serve for their entire lifetime or until they choose to retire on the Supreme Court, right?
There's definitely no number of justices that are specified. It's specified through Congress and through an act of Congress. It can be changed. And we've actually had different numbers throughout American history. The practice has differed. And this isn't the first time that we've talked about increasing the number, specifically to alter the court's view when it's gone off the rails. The other time that this happened was Franklin Roosevelt threatened to pack the court during the New Deal when his legislation was being shut down, and he didn't pack the court. Now, why didn't he do it? There are differing theories, but one thing that we know happened is the court started upholding the New Deal. We're talking about things like minimum wage legislation, workers' rights legislation, the National Labor Relations Board was at stake, the New Deal itself. And as the court got more sympathetic to Roosevelt, he stopped threatening it. Now, that's a very controversial moment in American history. But what we have now that we didn't have then was a Senate that was really playing fast and loose with their constitutional obligation. They were obligated to, they could have voted Garland down, but refusing to have hearings was a real dereliction of duty. Now, what do you do when there's a dereliction of duty? Some people will say two wrongs don't make a right, but I think it has to be on the table to think about adding that 10th seat, maybe adding Garland himself.
Right. And then there has been an effort to impose term limits on justices as well, lengthy term limits, but term limits nonetheless, because, of course, the two justices that Trump has had a chance to get onto the court, both Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh, are relatively young. That means that they, are going to be on the court for decades. He's considering a number of people. Likely he's going to appoint somebody or offer somebody up who is extremely young. Amy Coney Barrett is one name, a very young woman. That means that, a 6-3 conservative tilt to the court could be set in stone for a long time, or until, someone like Clarence Thomas might retire or pass away, yeah, or some of the other conservative justices that are older. And so, this seems to be a very, very critical issue, right?
I guess my view is it is possible. Look, if we could avoid packing the court in this, what will hopefully be a new administration, we should. And one thing might make sense is to wait and see how, whether they go the way of the court during the New Deal and don't interfere with the progressive agenda of this new president, what will hopefully be a progressive agenda. But if they do interfere, for instance, one of the main things, if they say that it's unconstitutional to enact Obamacare or related healthcare proposals, then I think we're in the realm of needing to pack the court. Or if they were to say not just that Roe v. Wade isn't good law, which I think they will say, but that we can't pass national legislation to protect the right to an abortion, one of the first things that we should do if there's a Democratic president and a Democratic Congress, then I think the argument gets very compelling for court packing. So I'm not totally sure yet, but it's on the table right here.
And of course, doing that sort of thing requires a bold president. If Joe Biden wins the election, unfortunately, he is very much a centrist establishment Democrat whose hallmark has been caving, lacking a spine, going with the flow and allowing Republicans to run roughshod over them. They don't play dirty or even aggressively when faced with Republicans doing the same. And so it's certainly a big risk. Let's talk about the numbers needed. If Trump does put forward a nominee, and he said he's going to do so Friday or Saturday of this week, and if it were to actually be somebody who's confirmed or even with hearings held, it would be an incredibly, incredibly fast process to begin with. And I understand that, of course, because of the Democrats, changing the rules, which has now come back to haunt them, Republicans just need a simple majority. That means they just need 51 right. votes on the Senate. So they have 53 seats. And if you want to overcome Vice President Mike Pence's tie, the Democrats need all of them to keep, to vote against this nominee. They also need 4 Republicans to switch parties, to switch party allegiances, right?
Right. And, that's possible. And it's the first thing to do is to try to stop this nomination, this consideration of putting this nominee on the court. And we've got Susan Collins and Murkowski saying that they won't support putting this nominee up. And Romney is a possible third. There's also this Arizona Senate race. So if a Democrat wins that, that might be a fourth vote.
And that's right. The special election in Arizona, results of which could be, a Democrat could be seated November 30th.
That's right. And so delaying until then and then having the fourth seat that way, Cory Gardner is another possibility. But I do think that the strategy right now is maximum pressure on those senators, on those close races where, they don't want to lose their seats. And so make them see that choosing Trump is a loss of their seat. There's no self-gain in it. The only reason to support Trump in the first place for them would be self-gain. And so if we as citizens can make it clear that's not going to happen, I think that's the most immediate thing that we can do. And of course, that would avoid, I think, having to really get into this stuff about court packing and more radical action.
Right. And so if you haven't, Mitt Romney's made it very clear he is in the anti-Trump side of the Republican column. If he were to join Murkowski and Collins, we would really just need one other Republican who might be feeling the pressure, you know, and it could be in any number of folks who are facing close races. But what and it could be the Arizona elected person as well. But what about Democrats? Is it safe to say that all Democrats, including, say, a Doug Jones or Joe Manchin, will stand firm because they too face close races?
I know. I mean, it's a frightening thought, but the idea that, you know, this is the single most important vote these people will take in their entire career. And, you know, give me a break. You cannot try to save your seat at the expense of the future of the American people. We're talking about gay rights, the right to privacy, the right to abortion, voting rights, the future of America to be a democracy. If any of them even consider voting to push this nominee forward, they're no longer Democrats in any sense, and there has to be severe retaliation at the poll.
And also, we have to remember that a presidential term, if Trump were to lose this election, his term would end not on November 3rd, not on December 31st, but on January 20th. So even if he were to lose the election, it is still possible, if he has the votes in the Senate, that he could appoint a justice as he's leaving his seat, his position in the White House.
I think that's possible. You know, this is a person who wants to hang on to power at all costs. You know, I guess one thing, hopefully, is I think if he loses, he's such a narcissist that he'll be so despondent. My hope is that he'll give up. And, you know, I don't think he cares about the future of the Supreme Court. None of these issues matter to him. The idea that he's really a pro-life president is a joke. So I think, you know, if he loses, let's just hope that his sense of self-destruction is so strong. He's facing criminal charges, for instance, that he'll give up. The one thing, unfortunately, that he might be thinking is that if he can put an ally there, then maybe there's some way through a court challenge of what might be the inevitable criminal prosecution he faces, that he'll have some allies on the Supreme Court.
And we know that he thinks that way because he thought that one of his relatives, like name now escapes me, on a federal judicial post would be a feather in his cap, you know, some ally that he could count on. We know that that's how he thinks. He's even, by the way, said on Saturday in North Carolina, he said that, you know, he thinks that the outcome of the election itself could be something that federal courts could step in to decide.
And let's not forget, you know, we were talking about RBG's legacy. One of the things that I highlight in the book, and she read this Dissent from the Bench, and so I recommend the audiobook on this to listen to her words spoken, is Bush v. Gore. And what she essentially said is that was a lawless decision. The Supreme Court was faking it when they said, with an insult to her and her jurisprudence, that this was about equal protection of the law and equal votes in the Electoral College's official process. No, it was a partisan decision where Republican justices, Scalia leading them, put a Republican president in that Oval Office. And that could happen again. That's the danger. And I think her legacy is, let's read that dissent and see that we've got to stand up to a lawless court if it does such a thing. And I'll tell you, if they do that, then there's no question again. Bush v. Gore should have, you know, brought retaliation against those justices for what they did. And if they do it again, they've really lost any ability to call themselves a law court. They're a despotic group of actors if they try to put the next president on the court.
Well, stakes have never been higher, perhaps. Corey, thank you so much for joining us today. We will post a link to your website and also information about your latest book on RGB. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for celebrating her life with me.
My guest has been Corey Brettschneider, a professor of political science at Brown University. His books include When the States Speaks, What Should It Say? How Democracies Can Protect Expression and Promote Equality, and The Oath in the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. His latest book, just published, is Decisions and Dissents of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, A Selection. We've been discussing, in addition to her legacy, the political battle to replace her on the Supreme Court. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali. KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. A massive trove of leaked documents from the U.S. government's Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, or FinCEN, shows that big banks filed so-called suspicious activities reports on trillions of dollars worth of transactions linked to corrupt regimes, mobsters, and international criminals, relying on the U.S. government to not enforce regulations. As a result, the banks engaged in what can only be characterized as massive money laundering schemes that have now been laid bare. Among the high-profile clients of these big banks is President Donald Trump's former campaign chair, Paul Manafort. The so-called FinCEN files have laid bare the failures of the U.S. government to counter the money laundering schemes, failure so staggering as to amount to complicity. The suspicious activities reports, or SARs, were first leaked to BuzzFeed News, which then shared them with the International Consortium of Journalists, whose staff worked for months to analyze and make sense of them. One of them is my guest, Spencer Woodman, a reporter with ICIJ. Welcome to the program, Spencer.
Thanks for having me.
So first, tell me about these suspicious activities reports, a little bit more about the documents, the fact that I believe it is the banks that file these, and then the U.S. government is supposed to act on them, but apparently hasn't.
Yeah, sure. So these reports are banks are required to file these reports under U.S. law. If they operate with a U.S. dollar account with the Treasury Department, which is every bank in the United States, and then banks that deal overseas in U.S. dollars. The banks are required to file these if they suspect or have reason to suspect that there is illegal or illicit conduct occurring through their accounts, or if certain dollar thresholds are met. So, you know, these reports in many ways kind of underlie and underpin the global effort to fight flows of dirty money through banks. But they often, the reports are so numerous that Treasury Department officials often can't read through all of them individually. And what we see is our banks filing reports over and over again on big and lucrative customers, and action not being taken.
So I understand that the banks are required to report these, but they can simply report them and allow the transaction to still go through, thereby garnering them a pretty nice transaction fee.
Right. So there's this whole concept of quote unquote defensively filed report. And that idea is that the bank can simply file a suspicious activity report on a problematic client, keep working with that client, and feel that it has met one of its major regulatory obligations in simply reporting it.
So let's talk about the fact that these documents were leaked to BuzzFeed News, which shared them with you. These are documents that the Financial Enforcement Network basically sat on, right? This is part of the U.S. Treasury. And how long did your journalists with the ICIJ work on these? What was the, you know, what was the sort of broad view of what these documents show in terms of the banks involved and the clients they worked with?
So we worked on this project for about a year and a half.
Wow.
Some partners came in later. I probably personally worked on it for closer to a year. But it shows really in some cases, unchecked flows of dirty money around the world. Maybe most significantly, it shows an enforcement regime that is unable to meaningfully deter banks from working with suspect customers. I did a story today. We published a story I've been working on for a little while today about HSBC, which was subjected to a historic fine for money laundering lapses in 2012. But what we saw what's significant about that case is that the Justice Department declined to indict the bank, even though it had prepared charges relating to these money laundering lapses. Instead, the Justice Department decided to give HSBC a fine and have the bank promise that it would do better. Our story looks at what HSBC did in the years after it promised the DOJ to improve its anti-money laundering systems. One shell company that we see in our files started transacting the day that HSBC's attorneys were meeting with Senate investigators on Capitol Hill in 2012 in a money laundering investigation. Over the next 2 years after HSBC made its promise, that company moved more than $560 million in transactions. We also see that HSBC knew that one of its customers was accused of being a massive Ponzi scheme that ripped off low-income investors all around the world. In these files, we can see that they repeatedly filed suspicious activity reports on this customer that was under investigation in multiple countries for Ponzi activity, and they continued processing the transactions, tens of millions of those transactions.
So that right there is an example of how this massive money laundering scheme that these big banks are engaging in are hurting ordinary people. So how does it work from the perspective of the criminal who wants to clean their money? Can you just go through the steps? Say you're a criminal who has ripped off a bunch of people. You can't just use the money that you've gotten from your illicit activity, because you need to explain where it came from. It has to be laundered. So how did the big banks get involved?
So this can happen a few ways. You can set up a shell company that has obscured ownership and that is difficult for a bank, a compliance officer, a law enforcement agent to understand basic things about. We saw a lot of that in our reporting in Hong Kong and around HSBC Hong Kong, where there were very opaque shell companies that compliance officers really struggled to get under. Or you can operate through what you call a legitimate business. So this Ponzi scheme was trying to sell itself as a legitimate business. It was not a shell company. It was a company operating out in the open. But the problem was it was under investigation all around the world. But in both cases, the people committing wrongdoing are seeking a bank that will not ask too many questions and continue moving their money regardless.
Is this where the big banks come in, or are there smaller intermediary banks?
No, we're talking about big banks here.
Okay.
You can use a small one too, but for international, especially for international wire transfers, which are a big part of any sort of big business, you're gonna have to at some point rely on a big bank, and the reasons for that are complicated and have to do with how electronic wire transfers in the U.S. dollar are processed and enabled. But this project essentially is all about the biggest banks in the world.
And so the banks make their money from the transaction fees, right? They're basically taking a bribe to launder the criminals' money.
They certainly make money from transaction fees. They also, if they're banking a direct client, they get to use that money. They make money in all sorts of ways. If you've got $100 million in a bank account or $100 million flowing through a bank account, there are several ways a bank makes money off that, and that is big money that they get good profits off of.
Right, so they're not just moving the money around, they're using it to make more money in the way that banks use any deposits to make money. From what your reporting shows, there are some very clear clients that show up, the high profile ones. Give me a sense of who these men, and they're mostly men, and there's some women there, are. One of them is Paul Manafort, Trump's former campaign manager.
Yeah, so we were intrigued by Paul Manafort's emergence in various SARs because it almost operates as a bit of a case study. I mean, we have a bunch of case studies for this phenomenon of banks filing these reports and then taking no action. But the extent to which banks repeatedly filed these suspicious activity reports on Paul Manafort, just millions and hundreds of millions of dollars moving through companies he controlled and people linked to him controlled.
I imagine that some of this covered the time that he was acting as Trump's campaign chair.
Oh, of course, right. It went all through that, and then even when Manafort had to step down from his position in the Trump campaign because of accusations, including money laundering, JP Morgan continued to move his money for a period of time, and that was in the multiple millions of dollars. When you have a client who is accused of money laundering, that is just about the biggest red flag there is. So the Manafort items kind of epitomize some of the broader topics in our investigation.
The rest involve, there are some government officials of various governments in various countries of Kazakhstan and Nigeria. Are there narco traffickers? We know, for example, Deutsche Bank was involved. There was a book written about it that we had covered on our show. Deutsche Bank basically working with narco traffickers. I imagine that some of that was captured in these SARs, these suspicious activities reports as well.
It's almost all there, really. You name it. We also have just various reports of the major oligarchs in Ukraine and Russia and other former Soviet states moving vast, vast amounts of money through the international system. One thing oligarchs like to do is to buy their own little banks to enable having your own bank helps you shuffle your money around more to one's liking, I think. And so what we found is that a few major Western banks even maintained direct relationships with banks owned by oligarchs who had been subject to serious allegations of organized crime ties or money laundering.
So what should FinCEN have done, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network? This is the government agency that these banks filed these suspicious activities reports with, you know, essentially knowing that FinCEN would sit on them and not actually do anything. What ought it to have done?
So, you know, FinCEN is one of many government agencies and offices that participate in trying to enforce anti-money laundering laws. FinCEN is I at least regard it as a bit more of an intelligence agency or an intelligence office than a law enforcement office. It's really the its primary function, from what I can see, is really collecting information. So what should FinCEN do better? It looks like they could take more of an active role in ensuring that these suspicious activity reports are filed in a high quality manner and in a timely manner. They do take action against banks sometimes for failing to report suspicious activity and things like that. But the reports we saw often were of a very low quality. FinCEN could probably help with that. On the broader question of which agencies and offices are responsible for really holding banks to account, that falls more on the Justice Department, which can bring criminal charges. Over the past several years has repeatedly declined to in these high profile money laundering cases, and also the various other offices within the Treasury and the Federal Reserve.
So the Treasury, which is where FinCEN resides, the FinCEN agency is supposed to collect these reports, and ideally we would expect the Justice Department, in conjunction with them or getting that information from them, to then actually move forward with criminal charges. The DOJ hasn't done much. Is it just during the past 4 years, or even under, say, a liberal Democratic president like Obama, was there inaction from the DOJ?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Obama was harshly criticized for not bringing very many criminal prosecutions and against big banks. There was even a lot of support within the public after the financial crisis for big banks to be held to account, and his Justice Department repeatedly, in some cases, did bring charges, but then did not indict, did not actually follow through with the prosecution. And that was really kind of where the era of so-called deferred prosecution agreements, where banks get off the hook, pay a fine, and promise to do better, reached its peak. Although we still see a lot of them, a lot of those arrangements continuing.
So the U.S. government, by its inaction, would you say is complicit in enabling these trillions of dollars of dirty money to be laundered through big banks? I mean, you know, banks are going to do what banks do. It's up to governments to hold them accountable.
You know, I don't think we can really expect any private enterprise that is driven by an incentive to increase profits to always play by the rules. And I do think it comes down to strong regulation and law enforcement in an area like anti-money laundering, where the potential upside of working with dodgy clients is just millions and millions in profits, even for individual bankers. So I do think that law enforcement has a big role here. And critics have, you know, this is not the first time that critics have spoken up and said that maybe big banks shouldn't be above the law when it comes to indictments and actual prosecutions.
And we can hardly expect the Trump Justice Department to suddenly begin enforcing these laws, even though, of course, Trump has called himself a law and order president. Attorney General William Barr has made it very clear that the Justice Department is there to serve Trump. They're not going to go after someone like Paul Manafort necessarily. What do you hope the public gets from this? I mean, we've seen stock values for some of these big banks that are named in these documents come down in the days after the reports were released. But I imagine that they're relying on the public's attention, government's attention, to simply fade and move on, and their stock prices go up, and them to continue with business as usual.
You know, I think a big lesson here is that it all comes down to incentives. And if a bank sees that the cost of working with dodgy clients is worth it, whether that be a regulatory cost or a fine slapped on them by the Justice Department, they may continue to do that. And the potential benefits of working with criminally connected clients up to no good is really tremendous, because a lot of people with a lot of money earned that money in ways that in U.S. and international laws frowned upon.
Where can people find out more about the work you do, and even, you know, dig through the documents themselves? I understand that you've published them all.
We have not published all the documents. We've published certain segments of certain documents. Go to our website, icij.org. That's for the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. And the whole project is there.
ICIJ.org, and we'll link to that from our website as well. Spencer, thank you so much for joining us today, and good luck to you.
Okay, thank you so much.
My guest has been Spencer Woodman. He's a reporter with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, and he's one of several journalists at ICIJ that worked on the FinCEN files that we've just been discussing. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Bus is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
Good morning. I'm Eileen Alfandari with KPFA's state and local news for Tuesday, September 22nd. California has passed the grim milestone of 15,000 deaths attributed to COVID-19. A report from Kaiser Health News says that's almost certainly an undercount, and that Latinos are the most likely to be among those who died from COVID-19, but whose deaths were not attributed to the disease. Kaiser Health News says in all about 125,000 Californians died from March, when the pandemic took hold in the state, through July. That marked a more than 14% higher death toll than that same period the year before. 9,200 deaths were attributed to COVID during that period. That left 5,000 excess deaths likely caused by the coronavirus. So-called excess or unattributed deaths were highest among the state's Latino population. The report said counties in Southern California and the Central Valley, which have higher numbers of Latino residents, tended to have higher rates of excess deaths from March to July. The state's overall infection rate from the coronavirus has been dropping. California Governor Gavin Newsom yesterday discussed the COVID crisis and the state's overwhelmed unemployment claim system. Max Pringle reports.
Newsom said the state's coronavirus numbers are trending in the right direction. He said coronavirus hospitalizations are down about 25% in the past 2 weeks, as are ICU admissions. The state has also struggled since the start of the outbreak to keep up with the rising number of unemployment insurance claims. Newsom said the record number of claims overwhelmed the Employment Development Department's outdated computer system.
This system is an old, 30-plus-year-old technological system. For those that understand a little bit about technology, these are the old COBOL systems, these legendary COBOL systems that need to be upgraded.
Newsom said he assembled a strike team to put out a report on the problems and make recommendations for what to do about them. Catch up. Newsom also said California, like other states, has been dealing with an influx of fraud activity from criminals hoping to take advantage of the pandemic situation. For KPFA News, I'm Max Pringle.
The family of Miles Hall has reached a $4 million wrongful death settlement with the city of Walnut Creek. The 23-year-old black man was having a mental health crisis when police were called in June of last year. Police ordered him to drop the object he was holding in his hand. When he didn't, they fired a beanbag round and then live ammunition. Hall's mother, Tawn, said the foundation the family has set up in the wake of her son's death will pursue nonviolent, non-police responses to people experiencing mental health crises.
So the settlement is not justice for Miles. There's no justice here today. None. We will find justice when we have other opportunities and other ways that our loved ones can get help and they don't have to call the police. We want a 24/7 non-police response to the mentally ill. We want to have people who are trained to come and take care of our children and take care of our loved ones with compassion and care, not with guns, not with military lineups when they know your loved one is sick. We have to do better.
Hall's family had worked with the police ahead of time to try to ensure the safety of their son. Family attorney John Burris said despite that advance work, police used deadly fire instead of de-escalating the situation. A wildfire making a run through brush and timber from the mountains to the desert northeast of Los Angeles is threatening more than 1,000 homes. Authorities say the Bobcat Fire continues to threaten Mount Wilson, northeast of Los Angeles, and towns in the Antelope Valley on the other side of the San Gabriel Mountains. California Governor Gavin Newsom has frequently invoked the climate crisis as epic wildfires ablaze in California, but climate activists are urging him to make good on the rhetoric. Today, a group of more than 300 local elected officials from nearly every county in the state is urging him to declare a state of emergency over the climate crisis. They want him to advance the date by 10 years for a transition to 100% renewable energy to the year 2035. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area, partly cloudy this morning, then sunny, breezy afternoon, highs in the mid-70s around the Bay and Fresno in the central San Joaquin Valley, sunny and hazy, a high of 90 degrees. KPFA, KPFB Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 Fresno, K2 for APR 97.5 in Santa Cruz, online at kpfa.org. 6 a.m., Democracy Now! Is next.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kbu.fm.
Hi, I'm Marcia.